Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is the remarkable Constantine Phipps. He's here from London. His new book, What You Want, has just been published in America, and it's an entirely singular book. I was lucky enough to be part of a chain of readers. I think I can name them. They'll be known to many of you. It began with the novelist and poet Harry Matthews, who spoke to the short story writer and novelist Ann Beattie, who called me and said, there's an amazing book called What You Want. It's been written in couplets. It's the story of the disintegration of a marriage, and it's enormously funny, enormously literate, enormously well written. Let's hear the opening section. This is Constantine Phipps reading the opening of What You Want.
When I was about halfway through life, always a cheery moment, I lost my wife to another man. As is the natural way, when a woman leaves her man of yesterday, she kept our child. Naturally, too, she got our home, and I was the one who moved out of our apartment. So at a stroke, I found I was a lonely single bloke, without the intimacy and protection which family life confers, or its affection. At this point, I should probably have known there was no going back. I should have shown some realism, at least. Dignity and guts, above all, were the qualities I needed now, rather than wishful thinking about what might have been, or whiskey drinking and evil hangovers. But something happened. A mood came down on me which left me flattened, unable to act at all. My head was filled with fantasies that we might still rebuild our marriage, that Louise might still come back, perhaps out of concern for our son Jack, perhaps even for my sake. My confusion fostered every order of delusion. Does everyone have moments when they feel like this? Like air out of a wheel, my confidence began to leak away. At work, I found a setback would convey immediate feelings of defeat. And yet, when things went well, I didn't seem to get a compensating feeling of success. At home, my confidence was even less. Alone, without even the antidote of work, depression gripped me by the throat. Choice was an agony. The smallest act of daily life would put me on the rack. Even to get the doorbell or the phone was to be dreaded. Better to postpone every decision, shut out every friend, and lose myself in sleep. But even then, disturbing thoughts still woke me in the cold of night like punches. You are getting old. Your woman left you. Do you wonder why? This is called failure. Soon you're going to die. A sympathetic friend would surely say, you've only started thinking in this way because you're depressed. But you despise the siren comforts offered by these lies, however well meant. It is clear to you, you feel this way because these things are true.
That's Constantine Phipps reading the opening passage from What You Want. Now, what everyone is dying to hear, why a novel in verse?
Well, I think verse does give it something extra. I mean, people have known for a long time since Isocrates that verse gives something extra. You accept the discipline, it gives you restrictions, but from that you gain a little extra power, and that's what I wanted for the book.
Well, it's amazing how clear the versification is. I could sit and read it for 40 pages at a time without feeling blocked the way people usually say they feel by poetry. You really managed to make this a comfortable form.
No, well, thank you. It was always my idea to make it something that could be understood when heard read aloud for the first time. So what happened in poetry, I think, was in the 20th century, it became a lot more dense. And this is something that hadn't happened so much before, and it led to poems becoming more difficult to understand and led to some very beautiful poetry. But that was poetry which you had to reread, which you had to think hard about, which you couldn't race through. And if you're hearing something read aloud for the first time, you can't do that.
Usually heroic couplets are called heroic couplets because they deal with heroic deeds. These are about daily life, and they tell us about a man who, like Dante, is at the midpoint of his life, and now he's being led back through his life by no less than Sigmund Freud, who's taking him on a guided tour, a dream-guided tour of a park, sort of like Disneyland, that's been made out of the events, often unhappy, of his life. His first love, his first job, all of these become castles and buildings of various sorts, all of them with theme shops to be visited, and Sigmund Freud on hand to explain life. Now, lovely, first of all, tell me, of all the guides possible, why Freud?
Well, this is a book about happiness. It's very much a book about how to live. And the question of how to live and the question of human happiness is a very, very ancient one. And that was something that I wanted to write about and which goes all the way through, skipping, I would say, a bit the years of Christianity and being taken up again at the Enlightenment. Now, at the Enlightenment, we have the Founding Fathers of America, who are a massive theme in the book.
Yes, George Washington makes a crucial appearance as a man who rejected not only being a king, but he didn't very much want to be a president either. He wanted to be an ordinary man, and the lesson of this book is ordinariness, is learning how to cope with the dailiness of daily life, yeah?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and after the Enlightenment, really the only person who I feel contributed hugely to the happiness debate was Freud. You know, I think Freud brought something to the happiness debate that hadn't been there before, which was essentially love and family life. And to go back to your original question, that was why I wanted Freud to be the guide.
I'm talking to Constantine Phipps about his novel, What You Want. It's just been published in America. It's a kind of dazzling book in that it imagines life or the meaning of life as illustratable in a theme park. In other words, it's a vast allegory of what might happen in a life if you disregard its substance. And our hero, whose name is Patrick, he's virtually dismissed all the possibilities of happiness. We seem at first to find him an equable bloke. You know, he's funny, he's friendly, but he's a liar and he's a betrayer and he's a schemer. And he doesn't know it. And everything Freud has to show him are things he doesn't know about himself. Most people go into psychoanalysis knowing that they're going to be shown things they don't know. But he's shocked by what is revealed to him. And in fact, we get shocked several times in the book, too, by revelations.
That's right. Yes. Yes, he does.
And there are other guides who come along. I think Plato makes an appearance.
Lots of people. They meet lots of people. It's like in Dante. They talk to the dead. They talk to all kinds of people. They talk to Jefferson. John Adams hangs out with them a bit. Washington, as you say, comes in. But every part of this theme park is an attraction of real life. So all the things that people want in life, which they think might make them happy, sex, marriage, work, drugs, religion, you name it, beauty, all those things we visit and we explore what they have to offer for our happiness and also how much Patrick, our hero, was made happy by them.
The woman he loves is named Louise. And you know, they've been married. They have a child named Jack. Ostensibly, the beginning of the dream is that, like any divorced dad, Patrick takes Jack to Disneyland, and he embarks upon his own theme park journey by dream, by night. But Louise, we discover, while beautiful, is extraordinarily cold to him and has rarely been anything else. At their very first meeting, they promised to see each other again the next day, and she's disappeared. She's been this way, and what we discover, and Patrick doesn't know it, is that he's addicted to her coldness. That he loves being treated in this way.
Yeah, that's absolutely right and very perceptive. And he has a kind of emotional pattern which he has to break free of or not. And it's interesting, there's another character in the book, one of his other lovers, this beautiful girl called Jane, has a very similar one. Both of them have lost parents in early youth for one reason or another. And Jane is sort of better able to deal with this, really, than Patrick. She goes out with a lot of married men and it doesn't make her happy, but then she's able to put that behind her and move on. Whereas for him, you sort of feel it's not so easy to do that.
And the book confronts the fact that over half of modern marriages end in divorce. And so the seeking for happiness in marriage is in itself an idea that the book has to question. Is this a source of happiness? Now, America plays into the book because we are famous for having said that we were in pursuit of happiness.
Absolutely. It's the subtitle of the alternative title of the book.
Now, do you believe in happiness?
Yes, I do. I think that the ancients were on the right path, which I think we drifted away from for a while in the West. But the Enlightenment picked it up. And I think the Declaration of Independence, you know, the pursuit of happiness, it's expressing a feeling that was around in the Enlightenment with Helvetius and other people, that somehow this ancient idea that man should seek happiness was the right one. And there's a discussion of happiness at the beginning of the book.
The book is structured according to its series of ideas. It begins with unhappiness, in fact. The second chapter is happiness. Hilariously, the third chapter, having gone through unhappiness and happiness, the third chapter is survival.
Yes. Well, it's the ultimate thing we want.
And the following chapter is sex. Then marriage, fidelity, children, work, and we're being taken in heroic couplets through the major subjects of our lives. Now, there's a certain hilarity about the audacity here, yes?
Well, good. I mean, it is meant to be funny.
Well, I found it funny, but in a very peculiar way, like a stand-up comic who's doing a routine that has never quite been done before.
Well, actually, Michael, funnily enough, rhyming couplets are a very good vehicle for comedy. Don't ask me why, but it does work very well. I chose rhyming couplets, actually, out from Chaucer. People say to me, were you influenced by all kinds of people who did it very well? But actually, the person who I looked to was Chaucer.
And what in Chaucer? In the Canterbury Tales?
Yeah, well, I love all of Chaucer, but he used rhyming couplets a lot in the Canterbury Tales, and that was what sort of gave me the feel that I wanted to have something very conversational. Actually, Chaucer's been criticised for being prosaic, and that didn't worry me at all. I never minded being prosaic. I just wanted that rhythm, and I wanted to be understood and entertaining, hopefully.
The situations in the book, although we may think at first with the vast theme park metaphor that this is going to be childlike, but the book is very adult and rather sobering. The question is what to do with the miserable depression that the narrator has sunken into. And the fascinating trick of this book is to have to make a narrator who doesn't quite know how bad his depression is.
Yes, and I think this is something that comes out of psychoanalysis as well. You know, the idea that things are repressed and you don't understand why you're unhappy. And that's what another reason Freud was the guide. It's also a very useful narrative technique because he just asks questions, you know. Analysts famously never give their views.
Yes, that's true. This is a scene in which Dr. Freud speaks his mind.
Yeah. He sometimes says things that have happened after his death, which is usually something that Freud didn't say.
Yes, of course. And he also tells us things that he's revised since his death.
Yes,
that
exactly.
He's had a chance to think over, including the death instinct.
Yes, yes.
It's wonderful to hear Freud say after his death that he's rethought the death instinct. But the other thing was you really made a decision that however many thinkers would appear in the book's goal was to be clear to the reader, clarity.
Absolutely right. You'll have noticed that a lot of the thinkers aren't named in the book. And that's because I feel that if an idea is clear, it doesn't matter who said it. And in that sense, authority is a bit of a contrick and can even degenerate into a sort of literary name dropping, which I hate. So I just wanted to put the ideas across, and at the end of the day, it didn't matter. When you read this book, it doesn't matter if you know who the people are or not.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Constantine Phipps about his book, What You Want. We'll continue after this short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Constantine Phipps about his latest book, What You Want, a novel written entirely in verse, about a man who explores every notion from Dante to Disney, leaving no stone unturned in his pursuit of happiness after losing his love. Now, without giving anything away, do you believe in Patrick's solution to his problem?
I feel that there are two endings on offer here.
Yes.
And you can take either or both. He's somebody who either he breaks free of his sort of psychological pattern and achieves happiness with another person, or he sticks with the marriage and makes the best of it. I think both solutions are offered to the reader in a sense.
Yes, both solutions are there. But he says at the very beginning of the book to his wife, Louise, and he knows, she knows that he's had affairs, she's felt betrayed by them. He knows, in fact, that she has had affairs, and the man that she's been having an affair with is a man she's serious about. She's known him since childhood. It's a man that she cares about truly. And he proposes to her that for everyone's sake, they keep up a marriage in name, that they continue to live together, to cope together, and only to hope that something may improve. Tell me, does that ever work?
I don't know. It doesn't happen in the book.
No. But it's what he wants badly.
He does, but he also knows it's a slightly crazy idea, I think.
Yes.
I mean, let's face it, Michael, it's often been done, you know, until the 20th century. It was the norm.
It was the norm. Yes, that's true. But marriage was not as dispensable.
Yeah, it was very different. And in fact, there's another character in the book who is an Indian Raja, and he and his wife were introduced only some days before they got married, but still found love. So I'm not trying to lay down any rules about how this works. There's also a passage where they go and meet Murasaki Shikibu, the author of The Tale of Genji, and she talks about in her story how all the men had multiple wives and concubines and so on. It was an entirely different society. But the interesting thing, emotionally, they felt the same.
Now, punctuating the novel, because, you see, ignorance is bliss. And gossip violates ignorance. And there are gossipers in this novel whose dark work spoils the Eden of apparent happiness.
Yes.
And it's very interesting because the novel rises to a kind of height of hilarity when a particular clothing designer is on the scene and she really knows how to gossip so that nothing will be left standing when she's finished with her insinuations.
That's absolutely right.
It's kind of marvelous. These become narrative devices to move the book along so that when an adultery is discovered, the consequence are several jobs that are lost, a need to repair the life from the ground up. You really put the reader through the paces in that most of us have been through something like this and have had to erect a theme park of our own in order to figure out what to do next. Is it universal? This need to create a theme park of possibility.
Yeah, I mean, the theme park was just an illustration of the things people want out of life. But I think that although obviously there are things in life that people want which aren't in this book, I think it's a fairly much an everyman compendium of the things people want in life. The wonderful historian Keith Thomas wrote a book called The Ends of Life about what people wanted in the early modern period, that is what we call the Middle Ages. And I was astonished by how much they corresponded to the chapter headings of my book.
Now, in addition to the stories told in the book, there are lyric poems that are more than couplets.
Yes, and they're slightly denser. Now, this insertion of poems within a story is something that's been done many times in the past throughout history. It was done by Boethius. It was done very much in Japanese tradition. They have a thing called a haibun, which is it has lyrics inserted in a narrative. And Peter Kornitsky, who's a professor of Japanese at Cambridge, told me that in his view, these inserted poems were like when you go on a walk and you stop to take a photograph. Now, I thought that was a very good comparison, but actually my inserted poems are like if I stopped on the walk to take an infrared photograph that would reveal the heat values of the scene, not just what you're getting in the narrative, but the underlying emotional reality of what's happening. And that's why I used them.
I thought also, like so often in poetry, especially with Yeats, that their attempts to arrive at wisdom.
Yes.
That the ongoing couplets have the hurtling forward of chronological event, but the lyrics are the still moments in
yes.
which the mind is trying to assess itself
exactly.
in relation to
and
the world.
And to come to the most deep emotional reality, as it were, the deepest implication for happiness.
It's lovely. Those lyrics, there's even an index of first lines
correct.
For the lyrics at the end of the book, so that in a sense, we can trace another plot through the book just by reading the lyrics.
Yes, yes.
It's like what they used to call in Shakespeare analysis, the double plot.
Yes, and of course Shakespeare used songs in his plays in a similar sort of way.
Absolutely, yes, yes, yes. Sing hey and ho and hey nanny mo.
Oh, all of those wonderful, wonderful songs, yes.
I've been talking with Constantine Phipps, author of What You Want, published here by Quercus. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
It's been a pleasure. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from What You Want at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Michelle Latiolet is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.